Like on socks.
That's it. Okay, well, let's get started. Good evening and welcome to the DMSC Masterclass. I'm Randy Danielson, and we're thrilled to have with us tonight Richard W. Dean, PAC, Distinguished Fellow of the AAPA. Rick is an absolute legend in the PA profession, bringing over 50 years of distinguished service as a clinician, educator, researcher, and advocate for our field, as we'll find out as we talk with him this evening. Rick currently serves as an emeritus professor at Northern Arizona University and the University of Iowa, and is a professor of practice in the Department of Biomedical Informatics at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. But his contributions extend far beyond his academic titles. Rick, welcome to the masterclass. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Randy, and thanks for inviting me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, Rick, your career trajectory is truly remarkable. And I'm curious, you earned your BA in history from the University of Iowa before becoming a PA. That's an interesting path. And could you walk us through what drew you to the PA profession so many years ago and how that history background has shaped your approach to healthcare and leadership?
Well, I grew up on a farm in western Iowa in one of the poor counties in the western part of the state. Very small town. I think our county seat had 3,000 people in it. You're probably familiar with those kind of places too. I went from there to the University of Iowa, the flagship university, strangely enough, as a music major. But after my freshman year, I realized I didn't want to be a junior high music teacher, and sort of cast about looking for, what in the world should I do here? And sort of got enamored by, large state university style humanities and social sciences, many notches up from what we sort of took in our small town schools, and ended up finally getting a BA in history, and of course in a big university that had to be compartmentalized. So mine was American economic history, and so that was my interest and fascination, and I started down the path to grad school, thinking that would be kind of a fine thing to do. And they one about 1 year in, they gathered all us grad students together and said, "There will be no jobs for you if you don't, have some big end. You should probably think of something else to do." So my something else to do was I got a job in the University of Iowa hospital system, which is huge, and as an orderly. That's what they called folks that did that in the early 70s. And eventually they decided after a few months that I belonged as the graveyard shift orderly in the emergency room. And from there, they started a they were just starting a PA program in the medical school at Iowa, and the ER supervisor faculty doc said, "Oh, we got a guy here," kind of thing. And so that was the very early days, and so that's how I got into the whole thing about PA. It was serendipitous and entirely accidental. Back to your question about history. Well, the thing that's interesting about history is sort of like, looking at change. And I can't think of anything else that personifies change, fast change, as much as the PA profession in the mere, what is it, coming on almost 60 years here now. It's been a radical change in healthcare delivery in American healthcare. So one, that just sort of fits the bill for me. And second, history is, looking at all kinds, many factors that may be involved in why things change. And so that really fits the PA field too, as our environment has been very fluid, and as we've sort of gained something, we've also gained new challenges as in a complicated way. So it lends to sort of the way you view history. Also, if you're doing that kind of work, you're probably getting to write quite a bit. So it fits in with, writing and scholarship and all of those kinds of things. So that's how that BA in history, which I really had no clue what in the world I'm just going to do with that. But that's it. I think it, in retrospect, it turned out to be one of the really valuable factors in my career.
Yeah, well said. I feel a lot like that myself. When I was in undergraduate school, my goal was to be a high school English teacher. So who knows what's going to happen. So your clinical career is particularly impressive. You've worked in family medicine, emergency departments, served countless underserved populations from rural California to migrant farm workers. Talk to us a little bit about your experiences in those early days as a clinician and what most shaped how you practice and lead today.
Well, I was always, my whole orientation from, I think, the very beginnings of thinking about, should I be in this? Should I apply for this new program they're putting together at the university? Was the my whole interest was my where I grew up. I grew up in a medically underserved community with people that were pretty poor, not very educated, and had and the medical care was and continues to be woefully inadequate. The stereotypical underserved, medically underserved rural community. And so that really informed me. And my first job wasn't a rural community like I grew up in. It was actually a dying urban community, one of those dying Midwestern industrial communities that that was challenging in its own way. And the first practice I worked in was in the heart of the downtown of a dying small or medium-sized city. And but it was interesting was that the family physicians that hired me because they'd been trying to get a physician to join them for years and couldn't get one. And I within my, I was there 6 months and I built a really tidy little practice, which then attracted the physician they'd been ne never able to attract. And I effectively sort of worked my way out of a job. I wasn't needed anymore. So my next job was I took a seasonal job running a mobile clinic for migrant workers in Iowa. And so what we did was we drove this Winnebago. It was me, a bilingual intake worker and an RN, and the three of us went from migrant camp to migrant camp. Places, even though I'd lived in Iowa my whole life and had been involved in agriculture, there are places and crops that I had never even thought of in nooks and crannies. And so we would, pull into a camp, stay there, and basically screen everybody that was willing for a couple of days and then move on. And that was a really an eye-opener for me because it exposed me to a different level of underserved. I thought underserved was people that were in communities that were relatively poor. I didn't think that they were in communities of people that actually were migrant and didn't live in permanent communities and really very seldom had any access to anything. So that was fundamental to me to do that job. And so those really informed me. The other factor that was important in my early clinical job when I was in the small city for the 6 months was they, in terms of trying to attract a physician for many years, they had always had a medical student rotating through their clinic for clerkships. And very I noticed right away that the medical students would follow me around and not the docs. Every one of them would. And I think the reason why was, to me, medicine was really rewarding and fun to share with people and really fun to work as a team. And the medical students would then end up, I'm looking back on it, they were the team with me. And that was the rewarding part of being a PA. And when they would follow the physicians, they would probably get lectured at, and they probably wouldn't get, conversed with and have much interaction with patients. It would be my guess. I don't know. But that was my guess. And so one of the things I realized at that point was I should probably have at least a toe in education. And that was an important thing to me. And so those, I think those were the really early things. When I moved to California 2 years after graduation, my first job was in the public health department in the third poorest county in California, in the San Joaquin Valley in Merced County. And again, there was a team of about five of us that did a mobile home clinic, of all things. And we went to migrant camps. In fact, one of the camps we went to in Planada was the one that's in the 1950s film, Grapes of Wrath, as a movie set, for all things. But anyway, so that was another, just another experience of looking out and working with the underserved and the populations around them. And those really informed my philosophy my whole life towards education, towards clinical practice, and towards policy and leadership.
Wow, what an experience. I just can't imagine. Rick, you moved into PA education relatively early in your career, holding faculty positions at UC Davis and later at the University of Iowa. At what point did you realize that education and program de development was your true calling? And how did your clinical experiences directly inform your work as an educator?
Well, when I was a year after I was in Merced, I actually got approached by Shirley Payne, who was an early PA educator. And she said, "Why don't you come work for us?" And UC Davis and Stanford cooperatively had programs up and down the county seats of the San Joaquin Valley. So there was a Merced satellite. That's where I was in Merced. And that job came with a half-time PA job in a community-based family practice residency. So it was a half-time clinic, half-time, both PA and NP students. And these programs were short. These programs were like 15 months. And they were the MedX model style programs entirely. They were the Western, almost the I guess the if you're familiar with them at all, you'd be familiar with what maybe MedX Northwest might have been like 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. Mostly in clinic and only time away from clinic to do really intense didactic training. But anyway, I was only 3 years out of school, and suddenly I had this job that was really two jobs. And real intense, and it was really quite a deal. But so I think when you practice half time and teach half time, that means that your teaching is going to be totally dominated by your clinic experiences. It's a much more practical clinic oriented orientation. And I think once I got into that about 5 or 6 years into it, I began to realize that I was probably more of a teacher than a clinician, or I would rather be teaching than seeing patients, though it really was something that I conflicted with for decades. And it was only 10 years after graduation that I started to realize that I probably was more of an educator than a clinician.
Well, one of your most significant contributions has been your work with PA program accreditation. And if I understand it correctly, you're a consultant for programs with the PATH program and as an accreditation site visitor and chair for ARC PA. Can you talk a little bit about why this work was so important to you and how it's influenced PA education across the country?
I think my getting into program accreditation is really almost my history of finding mentors. In my UC Davis era in the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s, that's it was 15 years in Merced altogether. I ended up coming into contact with Ruth Ballwig a lot. This year we were the Western Consortium, and that was a tight crowd of program directors and faculty. And Ruth actually asked me to do PATH, and I think that was developed in the around 1996, in that era when we went from 54 programs in 1994, 95 to a little around 100 programs 5 or 6 years later. And there were just lots and lots of programs in development. We didn't have the provisional accreditation system at that time. And so everybody was really worried about programs doubling in 5 or 6 years and what that meant. There weren't obviously wouldn't be enough faculty with any experience, and there wouldn't be program directors or even people that had been associate directors to lead those programs. And so PAEA, which was called APAP at the time, organized this process that they had consultants that went out and helped programs kind of figure it out. And it was kind of modeled on stuff that Norm Kahn had put together in family medicine. In the state, we're having the same issues in family medicine 10 years earlier, with a big demand for development of community-based residencies without anybody with any skill set to be able to do them. So that's how I got started. But probably within about 3 or 4 years of doing that, I think that APAP sort of decided that maybe they shouldn't be in the consultant business, and they sort of disbanded it. But those of us that were doing it and were interested in it sort of got folded into ARCPA. And so that's how I got started in ARCPA. When I moved to Iowa in 1993, Denny Oliver was the program director, and he was a very active site visitor. And through him, I got to meet John McCarty and various Laura Stutzer and various other people that were part of ARCPA. So that's how I got sort of folded into that crowd and got into the into the philosophy of how do the educators help other educators and programs meet quality standards, and what should those quality standards be every 5 or so years that they come around. And so that's the process that I got into, is how do the teachers help bring the teach and bring the quality of the programs to a certain standard, and what should that standard be? So I did that all together for about 19 years altogether. So I did my share of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you've shared some names of some real pioneers in the PA program history. So for sure. Well, also you've also been instrumental in advancing PA research and scholarship. You've held leadership positions with PAEA's Research Council. You've published extensively, including commentaries and JAPA on healthcare delivery issues. What inspired your focus on research and data-driven improvements in the PA profession?
Well, this is part of that. When we graduated in our era, Randy, we had to go out and sell ourselves to get a job. And sometimes you just couldn't do that. And in the second year that I was in Iowa after graduation, the job I always wanted became open 2 months after I moved to the practice I took in the small city. And so I thought, well, I'm going to take a job here and just wait until the job I want comes open. This is my young adult impulsive thinking. So I took a job as a research assistant at the University of Iowa and was hired by an epidemiology professor who was just starting to do research on the newly formed National Cancer Bank that was basically taking and putting patients in that had cancer of all types nationally. It's a big federal grant. And so he was taking and scooping off information about malignant melanomas and was trying to figure out what all of the different associative things from the data was. This data had just only been around a year or two. So, but this was the mid-70s. And so, I ended up, spending weeks in the library going through the Indicus, reference a big book and, finding all of what articles we wanted and pulling them out of real stacks and putting nickels in a Xerox machine, and Xeroxing all of these articles and doing that whole thing that you do when you do a research study. We basically got all of the literature, reviewed it all, figured out what was known about it and where the knowledge gap ended and starts. And then the next part of it was, well, gee, they had to figure out how to get this data out of these, big tapes that they had at this, centralized big IBM computer center that big campuses have. So I looked pathetic, and the PhD epidemiology students took pity on me and taught me how to program Fortran so I could take the data off on punch cards. And then I learned how to do SPSS and SAS on punch cards by going to little one-day seminars, which big universities would have, over in their computer burgeoning new young computer science departments. And so you'd run those overnight, and you'd get this big thing that just said they had all these errors and you had to do all that kind of stuff, but persisted and learned all those things. And eventually out of it, he wrote a paper on all the associations and statistical, correlations, of from large numbers of cases that were in the cancer bank. I did that for a year, and then I moved to California, and I kind of thought that was I thought I was just marching in time, waiting for a job that I never found as a PA for a year. And but later, in about 5 years later, all of a sudden these opportunities come around for me to be able to do projects that actually involve collecting data and analyzing it. And I had these skills, and by then we were had really, really clunky, big, heavy, old, expensive PCs. And we ran these floppy disks, and you could buy SPSS for students for $50 in floppy disks, and you could do all of this same stuff. So surprisingly, this marking time thing, done with no purpose towards research, probably was a really fundamental training for me. And I had the guy I was working for made me audit the whole MPH curriculum when I was doing it, so I didn't get an MPH, but I certainly turned into a public health type person from my exposure to it. So it's another one of those kind of serendipitous things. What I thought was marching in time and wasting time turned out to be an incredible skill set that otherwise I probably would have had to go back to a research-oriented training of some kind to get that same experience. So that's how I got in it. And then, I've always been interested in those kinds of things. So when I was in the residency in Merced, they were trying to, get residents to do something. So I suggested to a couple of residents that we study literacy l levels in our very low literacy county indigency clinic that we were responsible for the patient's care for. And so we did that, and that ended up getting presented at STFM, and it ended up winning the UC Davis Network 10 Residency Network Award that year. So that kind of whetted my appetite for, oh, this is pretty cool. So that's how, that's how I got into that. When I fell into Iowa, I got into a place where there were people around me that could really mentor me and really help me bring these figure out how to do these more and how to be productive and how to be successful at them. So, but I had the basics already at that point. So that's how I fell into it. So it was a natural for me to fall into, when I would go to APAP meetings. I never went to them until I went to Iowa in 93, but right when Iowa sent me to them, and the first, thing I fall into is the research committee and run into, Jim Cawley and Rod Hooker and Bob McNellis and various folks of that stripe, Dennis Blessing and, that crowd, Don Peterson. All of those folks ended up becoming my mentors and my friends. And so that just went on from there. When that leadership of those folks turned over, then it fell in my lap. So that's how I ended up being the kind of the research committee chair and leader for a couple of decades.
Yeah, wow, what some great experiences. And since 2020, you've served as editor in chief of JAPA. And, how has this platform allowed you to shape the conversation within our profession? And what kinds of research and scholarships do you believe are most critical for PAs to be conducting right now? I am absolutely sure that you're inundated with different kinds of research and clinical review articles out there. But tell us a little bit about your experience.
Well, I, being somebody who doesn't dislike writing, which almost all the PAs I know and PA students I know, when they'd be really honest with me, they dislike writing, which is why they were in the sciences. But nonetheless, when I moved to Iowa, they, like everywhere, immediately people want you to do things with the state society. So I became the newsletter editor. They were having a lot of trouble getting a newsletter working. So I did that, and I would really enjoy being able to write descriptively about the successes and, as Ed Friedman always called them, the temporary setbacks of our legislative efforts, and try to write them in a way that would keep things moving forward. And back in that day, those were all published in paper and mailed out. And Leslie Cole, who was the founding editor of JAPA, told me later that she read all of those that she could stand to read. They all were sent to the AAPA office. And she particularly was attracted to my writing of those legislative challenges, I guess I would call them. And so in 1998, well, before that, I'd actually gotten recruited to write the last page essay in the Clinical Advisor. Now, how I got picked to do that, I have no idea, but somebody called me and said, "We'd like you to do blah, 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 and we'll even pay you to do it." So for like 6 or 7 years, I wrote the back page essay, trying really hard to avoid the, "Gee, an interesting thing happened to me on the way to the clinic today" essay, and instead writing things like, "Are we, are there too many programs, but, things that involved really a lot more global and external factors." And those were, I guess people liked them because they didn't fire me or anything for a long, they never fired me. So it went on for years. And Leslie was reading those, and she invited me on the JAPA board in 1998. And people would come and go, but they never asked me to leave. So I was on there forever. And then when they went to Wolters Kluwer and became less of an advertisement-oriented journal and more of a Ovid type of a download journal, and Reimer Bushford took on being the editor, he made me the research editor at that point. And that was my history of how I've been in JAPA forever. So back to your questions. Now that I've been the editor for 6 years, but what do I think about this? Well, JAPA has this. This is the good news and the bad news. The good news is that it's the flagship journal of the profession, and it has, PubMed indexing, and it has an impact factor, and it's a top quartile journal in its subject area and all those goodies. The bad news is that it has to appeal to nearly 200,000 PAs. So it really has a that's a challenge. And it's always historically been a good quality clinical journal. So the question has always been how do we do things? How do we manage to continue to do that well, but also probably publish things that the profession really needs to have published because we're PubMed indexed and all those other things I mentioned. We have a voice, and people outside our profession can find us through journals like JAPA. So mine is that, and so my goal coming on was to publish more research. And but I also the other pushback we got from that was we only wanted to publish research that was respectable, that folks would look at and say, yeah, that's good research, not a well, yeah, they published something like that, but this wasn't up to speed kind of thing. And so here's how I think in terms right now, and this is what I get to do as my editor in chief to a certain extent. But I think the most important things are research that describes our profession, that isn't going to get public, it isn't going to see, isn't going to have a good audience elsewhere. That's important because it describes our profession in ways that people that need to know about it, including folks in our own profession. And research that documents how PAs contribute to healthcare. That's really important too, as nobody else is going to write that and conduct that research and publish it, probably except PAs. Research that demonstrates care improvement or cost and value of PAs. Of course, we've all clamored for that forever. Is, PAs are real cost effective. Well, prove it. So we're really interested in anything that, touches on that complicated question. And then also, I'm always really interested in anything that shows anything novel about PA use and roles. And so one of those things is lately all of, it seems like a lot of large healthcare systems, and maybe not so large healthcare systems, decide that they're going to restructure and use PAs and also, and NPs to basically try to become more efficient and provide better care. I mean, it's basically, trying to do the right thing. And when folks often do QI projects on those with before and after, and I think those probably are really useful. They wouldn't really inform anybody other than folks in those specific institutions and settings unless they were published. And so I think that's another area that we've seen quite a bit of growth in, has been those kind of QI projects for, well, we, replaced our consult group with PAs, for ortho coming into the ER, and they were always available, and in such, it improved the accuracy of our admissions in ortho and reduced our, time in the hospital, et cetera, those kind of examples. So that's a long, circuitous answer to your question. And probably I end up getting into it a little too deeply because of my role in JAPA. But that's what I think is important. It's important in our profession to be able to have in the public domain and easily accessible information that shows that PAs are evolving into into new roles and really helpful roles in the healthcare system. I also think it's important to have articles that have to do with policy changes across the country having to do with our profession too, because I also it seems to me that the average reader doesn't really know the impact of a, state licensing liberalization in such and such a state. So I'm also really interested in folks doing research on the befores and afters of the impact of state law liberalization.
Yeah, well said. And another question, and I didn't send you this question, but it sort of fits in right here. The second journal in our profession that seems to be gaining importance is obviously the Journal of PAEA. Would you talk a little bit about, to our doctoral students out there who are looking at, what to write for JAPA, what to write for PAEA, a little bit of advice?
Yeah, we actually talk about this a lot between the journals, and not because and I, we view the journals as we're really one team, and we're synergistic, that we do actually have no competitive we don't have a competitive bone in either one of us at all. We think that the success of one journal is the success of the other journal, and so we start from there. But the bottom line for us is, where's a dividing line between what belongs in JAPA and what belongs in JPAE? I think that's probably your question. And it, I think our kind of current agreement, because this is a moving train, is that once students graduate from PA school, their PAs and things that describe them belong in JAPA. And things that have to do with students and all the processes and everything that happens up to the time they graduate, and maybe even up to the time that they take the pants and license. But once they become part of the PA profession and are able to practice as PAs, that's so that puts in an interesting no man's land, having to do with postgraduate PA education. We've been publishing quite a bit in JAPA on postgraduate PA education. I'm not sure if JPA has been publishing much in that, but I think that's probably likely an area that both journals may be publishing on. But right now, that's our boundary, I think. And we've got an interesting thing because both journals are Wolters Kluwer journals. And we have an internal thing now in when you submit, it'll ask if it's okay if we don't accept your paper, if we move reviews and all of our information and your submission into another journal that's Wolters Kluwer. And we can move, if we decide not to do it, we can just move everything over to the editors of JPAE by just clicking a click in the person doesn't even have to. They've already told us in the application that that would be okay with them. So we've made that back and forth easier for us and easier for the, particularly for the authors.
Yeah, that's really valuable information. Rick, moving on to another topic, your CV includes extensive expertise in computer programming, web-based research, testing technologies, database construction, skills that were far ahead of their time. And how have these technical skills influenced your approach to PA education and research?
Well, because I did the work with the punch cards in the 70s, I was a early adopter, PC nerd, and I developed those skills, and I developed one of my students and then graduate FNPs from my UC Davis days in the 80s. He would come over and we would nerd together on these, and he taught me TCP/IP networking. He'd come out of the of the Navy, and that's had been his skill set in the Navy. And so it was I gained this skill set. And when I went to Iowa, then I kind of hit this time in the 90s when all of a sudden stuff was moving from mainframes and dumb terminals into freestanding PCs, and everybody didn't have a secretary anymore. They basically had to write all their own stuff, and the whole transition into PCs, and having that skill set. There were a handful of us at the University of Iowa in the College of Medicine that had that educator and serious networking nerd type of skill set. And so I would get, rather than people having to come over and do all that stuff in your department, I would be given administrative roles, and I kind of took over sort of nerding departments and things like that, and doing that. And in the process of that, I got recruited into some things as the interface for developing software. And so we were developing testing software on the internet way early on, trying to get away from the Scantrons and all that kind of technology of the 90s. And the reason why it worked well for me to do that was Iowa has a small PA class of 25. That's a perfect, it's a perfect size beta group for working with some product that you're putting together. So I was always into that technology stuff. I put our, University of Iowa stuff into databasing really early. I hand coded the first PA website that went up. That was I coded in Notepad, coding it all by hand. It had about 5 pages, but it was the first one up, and so it was. And we had this thing where we started tracking students, by having them put all their stuff into Palm Pilots that we bought with a grant, So we started to figure out how to use technology, but it was really crude, and it required a lot of nerding. And I was able to recruit Teresa Hegman to be a co-nerd with me with that type of stuff. So we were able to do that kind of stuff. Now all that stuff's done really well by external vendors, and you don't have to do any of that stuff, and you mostly just have to know how to call tech support and know how to log in these days. But the other thing I think that I got into early was I did the PA faculty forum as a listserv out of the University of Iowa, because I realized from being a network administrator that that was available as a freebie in the university. So I could basically do, and that was our first PA programs connect and communicate. It was used heavily. It usually would have, a dozen or two dozen, listserv messages on it in an era when we maybe had 100, 120 programs. So that's always been my fascination. Now I find all of this stuff really annoying. And all this technology, I find it really annoying now. And that was the day. And I think that really helped me expand my network at University of Iowa, and really helped gave me and the program and our students a lot of opportunities to interface with all of that stuff. Of course, coming into that was teaching our students how to be, how to be a good with the literature, and how to be really good consumers of clinical research. That was all built into that too, of course, because you couldn't do that if you couldn't have the internet. So there you go. So anyway, that's, it was a really important part of my career.
Well, so one thing that I've learned today is some new words, nerd and co-nerd. So that's worth the time altogether. Let me ask you, your work at the University of Arizona's Department of Biomedical Informatics, that seems like a natural fit given the things we just talked about. What role do you see biomedical informatics playing in the future of PA practice and education?
Well, I think it's going to be huge. They recruited me because I think when they were putting the, they recruited me when they formed the department, and the College of Medicine in Phoenix from the University of Arizona is relatively new. So, they sort of blossomed up from a really, really small class of 12 or 20 into a big class of 120 now with the PA programs building with the Phoenix campus. So, I got recruited into that. I think it was 2015, and my sense of that was, I'm interested in this because I'm interested in finding sources of big data. You know, that's what I want to do. I want to work with big data and sort out provider types, you know, things like that. But then, you know, after being in the department a long time, the orientation of it is, how do you use technology to improve the population's health? How do how do you become more effective, more efficient, and more useful providers with tools of technology and big data? And that's what I've been watching. And I think that informatics is just going to become a subheading inside of AI, is what I think is ultimately happening in that. But I think that, you know, I've advocated for a while that we really should be doing some informatics basics in core PA training. And of course, the core PA training is already stuffed to the gills. And I haven't, regardless of my persuasiveness, I've been unable to successfully do that. But I think that that's it probably belongs there, not in a huge sense, but I think that it's going to be sort of like genetics. It's going to creep in and become a more and more important part of being able to effectively practice. And that's where I see it in the future.
Yeah, well said. I have a few more questions before we open it up to the folks that are here and finish this up. But Rick, you're a founding member and a former president of the Society for the Preservation of PA History, known as the PA History Society. Why was it so important for you to help establish this organization and lead this organization that's dedicated to documenting PA history?
Well, it's the natural fit for me, but it was another one of those things of the mentors I was around. I mean, Ruth Volwig goes, "Here, you need to do this." And Richard Rehr was, you know, those it was those generation of people before me that said, "This is what you should be doing." And it was a good fit because I agree with all of it. We knew that our history, a lot of it resided in our programs, a lot of it resided in the stacks of things that were down in the storeroom of programs. And as programs got bigger and there were no people there that were there earlier, that those things would probably disappear. And so that's why I think that came at that time, was this, we still think a lot of that's still around. Let's see if we can archive it and start the process. It fit for me. And I think that since the founding of it's been really nice. I think we've had a really nice progression of advocates and talented folks that have moved through and working in that organization, and we've managed to preserve quite a bit of a, I mean, Reggie was obviously the big driver of History Society, Reggie Carter. But I'm not a major player in that. Reggie is the major player. But I did manage to find a bunch of Danny Oliver's original proofs of his really, really old articles in the trash bin when we were cleaning out his office, that I managed to save, to rescue, and then basically get them in the History Society. So I mean, the truth of it is, all of us in our programs have got these important things, not just in programs, but in the institutions that we work in and the places that we've been a clinician. So I just think that it's so, when I give the talk on the history of the profession to the students that are in their first semester at NAU, the looks on about a third of their faces is that they had no idea of this and no idea of that and as such. So, you know, I think it's, you know, as a historian person, for me, it's obviously just remarkably important to have our history.
Yeah, well said. Ironically, the PA History Society did a survey last year at AAPA, and they asked the question, what war, what United States war was instrumental in bringing the PA profession forward? And I'm sorry to say that only 25% of the PAs who did that survey got the right one, but we did get some interesting ones like the Civil War, the Korean War. And like that. So I think your point's well taken.
Don't, I'm not surprised.
So Rick, many of our master class attendees are either early or mid-career PAs who are considering next steps, and the diversity is incredible from people who've been in clinical practice, who have been in academia, who have been in business, and have decided to move into having a doctor of medical science. What advice would you give to these folks who are thinking about transitioning into education, research, leadership, or other non-traditional clinical roles, like in the pharmaceutical industry? So what qualities or skills would you recommend that they be developing now?
I think the first step is to get several mentors. You should probably view that you want to transition to something almost like all of the PA wannabes that we see in programs, the things that they do to try to figure out how they're going to get to the next step when they're not really sure what that is. And that is go around and I would call them more mentors than people you're shadowing, because you're it's just a different level working at, but I can't stress the value of people that probably have their that are knee-deep in things that you think you might be interested in. Those people would be just really valuable, not necessarily people in our field. You know, people outside the field is where you're probably going to find opportunities that are not necessarily traditional. You know, things that are easy to imagine, those novel jobs that you don't know exist. I think the next thing would be, and everybody here has done this but me, and that is get your doctoral degree one way or another. Use it as an opportunity to sort of see what else what the world looks like from that perspective through your curriculum. It's an opportunity, view it as an opportunity that with your mentors probably is a really good, it's going to give you some good information. And then I think another part of it is often you're thinking of doing something like that. If you're in a place and you're thinking of leadership, you can probably manage to get yourself, get your, you can get your toe in by deciding that you would be happy to serve on a committee of something of some sort, and you can figure out if you think that messing around in that area more seriously would be something that you could do if you weren't so busy with your clinic or what else you were already doing as such. But I think that's a, you know, if you want to make a big transition like move into pharmaceuticals, that's going to be harder to do. But I think if you're thinking about leadership or you're thinking about academia, you know, the programs would just love to have you lecture on an area of your expertise, or would love to have you work with one of their labs or help them with one of their processes, and you can get a feeling of, you know, whether you that's a place you'd want to be doing that. So, I mean, there are some places you could stick your toe in, and I think take advantage of those. And then I think the other thing is sometimes when an opportunity comes along, you're only going to get that, you're only going to get asked, or that window's only going to open once. And if you dither around and play hard to get and you don't take advantage of it, the message that you convey is, well, you're not really serious about doing anything different. So a lot of the things that come along that are opportunities, you have to seriously think about, is this where I should take a leap? Your chance of moving into something like that is zero if you don't take a leap. But then also, obviously, the other side of that, it might not be the right leap. But I think you have to actually start to think about how much can I take a risk? What's my feeling about risks and opportunities? Because I have watched a lot of people walk away from obvious opportunities to do things that I think they would have really flourished in, and then down the road complain that they're really bored.
Well, very great advice. Rick, you were the 2024 recipient of the Eugene H. Stead Jr. Lifetime Achievement Award. Congratulations on that. Throughout your over 50 years as a PA, you've dedicated your career to strengthening the profession through service and research. We've talked about much of that tonight. And as a primary care provider, educator, mentor, and prolific researcher, you've made a significant contributions to the PA profession. Tell us a little bit about how you feel about that award.
Well, actually, I was really overwhelmed. I didn't know I'd been nominated, so it was shocking to me. And I think for several weeks I was trying to track down who was responsible for it, because I'd never really thought of, and I didn't really think about things like that. But I think it was humbling. I think it made me think a lot more about about my whole career, the things that I'd forgotten about. It made me think about the people that had mentored me and helped me and helped and got me a lot of the things that ended up helping a lot of other people in the process. And so I think that, that's what it meant to me. It meant the opportunity to and also an opportunity to try to encourage others. I think it, in some ways, the I'm not very comfortable in the spotlight, so my way of dealing with the spotlight is to try to turn it back around and figure out how I can help and motivate others. And so I think that was the impact of it on me. It's still hard for me to believe that that's an award that they gave to me.
Well, it's certainly not surprising to those of us who are here and throughout the profession. And and thanks for all that you've done. I do have one more question before we open it up, and that is, you've done so many things in the profession, and but what do you do for fun? Do you have any hobbies? What makes you have fun in life?
Well, I play a lot of music.
Do
I do,
you?
and always have played a lot of music. I played music on some level professionally, clear up to where I was about 60, and then it got a little bit too much to do. So that's my fun. And if I could have done anything that I thought was joyous my life, it would have been that. But I did this instead. So and I, I have a, I have a family. We were foster parents in our midlife, so we, fostered a number of children, and we adopted a couple of kids that we fostered. So, I've, a bunch of grandkids and everything. So we have stay busy that way.
Well, and thank you for bringing that up. I was hoping that you would about your dedication to your children and your foster children, and thank you so much for that. I would like to open it up now for anybody here who might have a comment or a question for Rick before we wind this up. So, if you just unmute yourself and just jump in, if you would.
Well, Rick, never being one that's shy.
I could count on you.
Rick, I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you telling your story. And as an early as a I'm not going to say I'm an early career PA, because I'm not. I'm the same generation you are, and had many of the same mentors you did. And I really appreciate the advice you just gave students out there, to take the opportunities when they present themselves, because you never know what path that may lead you down. And so I too reinforce that. In looking at your role as the editor of JAPA and your interest in promoting the profession. I think, one of the things I've pushed for since I was president of the Academy is that I always felt that the AAPA never had enough data on the profession. And we were always lacking because when we would go in front of legislators or administrators, we didn't have the, it was anecdotal data. We didn't have the facts and the figures that we really needed. And much of that was related, as you just sort of said too, that you feel that an interest that maybe JAPA can get into is looking at how regulation and policy affects the delivery of care. And I really think some of those, like you, I think many of the policies that states have and the federal government had were the barriers that allowed us to really gather that data. For example, incident two billing under Medicare and how can we can the data that's sort of lacking about how PAs contribute, what percentage of the healthcare visits, for example, are under PAs when incident two billing. So I really would like to I too am very interested in how we can look at the data now that since the legislative change of 2022 that removed the requirement to have supervision by a physician and direct reimbursement to PAs, much like the Balanced Budget Act did for the NPs. And I think that would be a great little history article. I recently gave a talk at Chapman University on how policy and healthcare policy affected or influenced the PA profession over the last 50 years. And maybe something like that, because when you also said that, and Randy, you also said it, the Civil War, we all know that's where PAs came from. Again, maybe an article, something like that, where the PA profession can sort of see the background and how policies that have influenced the course of the profession. I don't know how
Yeah,
you.
I can't agree with you more. It's been an interesting moving bus in that, at one point the AAPA census, included about half of practicing PAs, but once the logging was taken away by NCCPA in the early aughts, the membership really floundered after that because that was a major benefit of belonging to AAPA was that they would log all of your CME for the NCCPA, and a lot of folks could get their employers to pay for their membership based on that. It had to do with certification. So, and so the all that data that's most complete is now fallen into the NCCPA, who for a long time didn't want to do anything with it because they thought it was valuable and it had a revenue stream. But more recently, they've gotten into realizing that it's valuable data for the public domain. And I've been talking to them all the time. I've been editor in chief about, that's what can you do next as an article, and we can publish it in JAPA because they do really high quality work on their submissions, and we have gotten them to publish a number of those things from their profile. That's just the census-y stuff, which is, I mean, they're a really good source for that. But now, when incident two finally disappears and we get years down the road, we'll be able to track, the economics of PAs a lot more accurately, because incident two was really always the big problem with those NAMSIS and various other, surveys that were done, huge numbers that were done about outpatient visits and ambulatory care visits and stuff, trying to do research on those. A number of those basically were polluted because they were PA visits that were submitted as physician visits. You know the story. And so all of that data has always been really hard to work with. So I think we are as and what helps with that, I think the reform of that was mostly just a let's get rid of the abuse of the incident to process. But also part of that has to do with the practice reform and not having the supervisory stuff that really is the laws that were what worked in the 80s. So, it's a moving, it's really a moving target, but it's really hard to get big data with PAs. The best sources of it tends to be, from what I can tell, are these huge care delivery systems like Mayo and Cleveland and various others that have in themselves have a really granular data system, that have been coding things by provider, for a long time, because they use it for their own productivity determinations. And so those have been probably some of our best data sources, I think. But yeah, I agree with you. One of my first projects when I went to Iowa in the early 90s was, Iowa had, as usual, as most states like that do, have huge rural delivery of healthcare problems, and a handful of cities that don't have that problem. And the medical societies and all of the powers that be are all dominated by the urban physicians. And so they didn't, the Blue Cross Blue Shield dominated the private insurance industry there, and wouldn't pay for PA services, even though in the rural areas, PAs were providing a pretty high proportion of the care. And so the physicians that hired them just had to eat that in order to have, enough people to do their practice. And so I did a survey on Iowa PAs about the barriers to more effective PA practice in across Iowa, and I did it as a paper survey and got a huge response rate of 70 some percent. And it clearly documented that insurance payment was a major barrier to being able to provide care, particularly in areas that weren't urban. And Ed and Libby were able to take that into the legislature and counter the hearsay of, and all of a sudden Iowa passed reform that mandated payment for identical services for PAs and NPs. And this was like in the, like 1995 or something. And that substantially changed the playing field. And that's when I realized how valuable research was to counter status quo power, type of stuff, for, with a really powerful, rich status quo type of power plays in legislative and in these boards, and begin to realize how valuable that was. So, you're absolutely right. We have to do that. The problem is it just costs so much to do that kind of research. And we do have a, I think that one of the things that's true is we have more people qualified to do that type of research that are PAs than ever. I think the last time Jim and Rod and I were actually present together in place, we kind of had a discussion of how we were worried 10 years ago about what was going to happen to PA research. When we're gone and we're not worried anymore, it's in really good hands. So I think that's really true about our profession. We've done a really good job. The AAPA PAEA Research Fellowship, I think, is one thing that's contributed to that. I think also the realization around at least three of the four orgs that research really doesn't belong at the bottom. It ought to be high, but at least in the middle is better than it's ever been in terms of support. So I think we have more support than we used to in our major orgs.
Yeah,
Thanks,
thanks,
Ben.
thanks, Jim and Rick. Anybody else have any comments or questions before we close this off? Nope. Okay. Well, Rick, we could talk to you all night, and thank you for that. And any last minute comments before I have a few last minute comments?
I think the most important thing we're facing, frankly, is state regulation reform. And that's basically that's the big enchilada. That would be my guess. Having watched that type of reform for all kinds of things over 60 years, from very first state laws to prescription to fund to reimbursement and all those different things, that this is the biggest factor right now.
Yep, I think you're right on. Well, Rick, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Your contributions to education, research, leadership have really shaped the profession that we practice today. So, and to our attendees, thanks for your wonderful engagement tonight and being able to be here. Please stay connected with DMSC and look forward to our next master class, which will be on Monday, February 9th. At 7 p.m., our guest will be Dr. Sandra De Palma. As many of you know, Sandra is the Vice President of Reimbursement and Professional Practice at AAPA, where she is a national expert on healthcare policy, reimbursement, and professional practice. And she's been a PA healthcare leader and skilled advocate at the national and state levels for over 20 years, and a regular speaker at national conferences. So, she's an exceptional faculty member in our DMSC program as well. So please note that date. Join us when you can. And again, thanks for being here this evening. And Rick, thank you. And we'll say good night to everybody.
Thank you.